Chapter 9 A Labour Government, but where's the socialism? After the savage attacks on the working class under the Tory government, a certain relief was felt by workers with the election of a Labour government. Nevertheless, there was also a determined mood to push for the implementation of radical policies. This was demonstrated at the LPYS conference and rally at Easter 1974. Tony Benn opened the conference and praised the work of the LPYS in the election campaign, particularly the decisive intervention of 400 young socialists in the key Bristol South East seat. He conveyed the gratitude of the local party. He said that the Tories were out to neutralise the Labour government and exert pressure for the formation of a national coalition one. At this conference, Nick Bradley, the militant candidate from the Deptford Labour Party Young Socialists, was elected as the LPYS representative on the neck of the Labour Party by 143 votes, with his nearest rival, Rose DiGiorgio, receiving only 18 votes. All the meetings and the rallies were full to capacity, indicating that the LPYS was the strongest youth organisation, not just in Britain, but, certainly politically, in the whole of Western Europe. In Britain, following the election of Labour, workers were pressing forward in an attempt to ensure the implementation of the reforms which had been promised. In the health service, for instance, at Charing Cross Hospital, the NUP branch moved to ban private practice. This represented an attempt to force Health Minister Barbara Castle's hand, but reduced Tory spokesman to apoplexy. Militant reported already 110 hospitals in the northeast and many others in Yorkshire and Manchester have been operating a ban on private patients. The article pointed out, what has really sent a shiver through their spines has been that these workers have taken seriously the programme of the Labour government too. In retrospect and in view of the catastrophic position in the health service today, with the virtual dismantling of the NHS, these movements were extremely significant. It demonstrates that, if Labour had then based itself upon the movement of workers from below, and linked this to a change in society, the present health nightmare which confronts workers could have been entirely avoided. Ian Burge, a long-standing militant supporter and a leading steward at the London Hospital who tragically died in 1980, wrote in a characteristically incisive article, "Ancillary workers in some hospitals have in fact been operating sanctions against private treatment since the strike campaign on wages in early 1973. He demanded, "Take over the drug companies and use this money to pay the health workers a decent wage. Abolish private medicine, give all support to the health workers campaign. Let the health service be run by elected workers in the service, with trade unionist delegates from the district and government representatives 3. Scotland Home Rule." At the same time, in Scotland the future themes played out in full today were developing in outline. In August 1974, Militant carried an article headed "Scottish Parliament, Will It Answer Workers' Needs?" It pointed out that the Executive Committee of the Labour Party in Scotland had voted by 6-5 to recommend opposition to any form of assembly. The Scottish Labour Party, in effect, said that an assembly was irrelevant, stating, "The essential strategy of the Labour Party is to bring about a fundamental and irreversible shift in the balance of power and wealth in favour of working people and their families. In the light of this criteria, constitutional tinkering does not make a meaningful contribution towards achieving our socialist objectives." Militant was only just beginning to formulate a clear analysis and a programme which took account of the growth of national feelings in Scotland. Nevertheless, Militant argued, "If the majority of Scottish people desire a Scottish Parliament, or if there is a majority for complete self-government, this is the right, and Labour would be bound to support it. There can be no question of maintaining the United Kingdom against the will of the people of Scotland, for the national question in Scotland was to come back onto the political agenda again and again. It compelled the Marxists to undertake a re-evaluation of the issue and to work out a programme capable of answering the legitimate national demands of the Scottish people. We did not always have complete agreement within our ranks, even losing some supporters, when we argued for a programme for national rights. Subsequent events demonstrated that only Militant was capable of working out such a programme. This is one reason why in 1995, Scottish militant Labour has had a bigger effect on this and other issues than any other organisation in Scotland. October, our 10th birthday and a general election. October saw the 10th anniversary of the founding of militant. A special celebration article in the paper referred to the statements in our first issue. The editors claimed militant has lived up to those aims. The sunny optimism of the strategists of capital still lingered on in the early 1960s. They had relegated to the pages of history the terms slump and mass unemployment, poverty and starvation. They maintained that these denoted an age of barbarism which the new capitalism had put an end to once and for all. 5. The editorial compared the mood of the capitalists in the 1960s to that which existed in 1974, particularly following the Portuguese, Greek and US upheavals. Reflecting this pessimism, Willy Brandt, leader of the SPD, the West German Labour Party, had stated following the Portuguese events that communism, meaning in this case the taking of power by the working class, or fascism, was the choice Europe faced in the following 20 years. Militant believed the next stage in the struggle in Britain will be a further swing towards the left. However, victory over the Tories and the system which breeds them can only be achieved on the basis of the rearming of the labor movement with a socialist, a Marxist, program. 6. Militant support had received a big boost in 1973 and 1974. By July 1974, the number of organized supporters stood at 517. And this was underlined by the general election, the second in 1974, which was called in October. Labour won a tiny majority. The Tories were massacred in Scotland and Wales. In both areas they were forced into third place behind Labour and the Nationalists. The Tory party received its lowest ever share of the poll, a mere 35.7% of the vote. An indication of the swing towards Labour was that between February and October 1974 the Tory vote dropped by over 1.5 million votes. At the same time, the Liberal shadows of the Tory party had suffered a crushing rebuff, dropping 700,000 votes, while fielding an extra 100 candidates. Labour wins, militant warns capital strikes. The result meant that workers extended more time to the Labour leaders to fulfil their promises. The majority would have been greater if an enthusiastic radical socialist campaign had been conducted as urged by militant. Despite the victory, Labour leader Wilson announced on TV on the Tuesday following the election, the 8th of October, that he would immediately open talks with the CBI. Militant commented, "Along this road lies disaster for the Labour movement." It was not idle speculation when the editor of the Times commented 2 days before the election that the party that won the election would be the party most likely to be destroyed by events. We continued, "The top 20 companies are controlled by just 297 men. 85% of production is in the hands of 250 giant monopolists. 7. The government would either have to capitulate to the monopolies or rest on the labor movement and carry out socialist policies." The labor leaders advanced the idea of a so-called social contract, which was wage restraint by any other name. Within weeks, militants' predictions had been borne out, as sections of the ruling class threatened a strike of capital. Elkington Glass, for instance, had declared that they would refuse to invest unless the government capitulated to the demands of the CBI. This was followed by similar declarations by the bosses of Hawker Siddeley and Metal Box. We pointed out, what else is this but the most blatant blackmail? They are sending the CBI leaders to 10 Downing Street, with a savage threat to the Labour government, capitulate to us or else. In November, Labour held its rearranged party conference in Central Hall, Westminster, which lasted for only 2 days. The conference took place just 6 weeks after the election. Ray Apps, a delegate to the conference, warned of the dangers facing the Labour government if conference decisions were not implemented. He wrote in Militant, "It has to be said that the government has given into this, the boss's blackmail. Handouts of £1,600 million have been made to big business. 8. A few crumbs had been left over for the working people, in the form of family allowances and pensions increases, but these were to be delayed until the spring of the next year." As an indication of what was to come, the financial editor of the Times praised Chancellor Healey's tough orthodoxy. The conference reflected the outline of the future clashes in the party. Callaghan opened the conference with threats that inflation and unemployment would spiral unless the social contract was upheld. General Secretary Ron Hayward, on the other hand, attacked those who would treat the conference with contempt. He said that ward secretaries were more important to the party than ministers. The emergence of militant during the election campaign, and our growing strength, clearly reflected at this conference, sent shivers down the spines of the right wing. It set the scene for the witch hunt which was soon to begin, and unfolded over more than a decade, first against militant, and then against the rest of the left. Birmingham bombed in November, the horrific Birmingham pub bombings took place, resulting in the death of 19 people and the injuring, scarring and maiming of nearly 200 predominantly young people. Militant declared unequivocally bombings play into the hands of reaction. Militant had consistently opposed the oppressive role of British imperialism in Ireland. But at the same time we had opposed the disastrous policies of terrorism of the Provisional IRA. The extension of the campaign to Britain held out potentially disastrous consequences for the British working class. Militant pointed out that whoever planted them, the fact stands out that the Birmingham bombs can only benefit the interests of the enemies of both British and Irish workers. The immediate aftermath resulted in a backlash against Irish workers in Birmingham and other parts of the country. This was undoubtedly whipped up by the small fascist groups who reared their heads after the bombing. This incident also provided the opportunity for the British ruling class, through the Labour Home Secretary, Roy Jenkins, to rush through repressive legislation. This was the Prevention of Terrorism Act, which has been used to harass and intimidate innocent Irish and other workers for over 20 years. Moreover, the bombings led to the arrest of the totally innocent Birmingham Six and their inhuman incarceration in British jails. It also created the hysterical atmosphere which was to later lead to the jailing of innocent people like Judith Ward, the Guildford Four, and others. Militant reported. At the huge British Leyland Long Bridge factory, fights have broken out between British and Irish men who have worked together for years. In 30 leading Birmingham factories, workers have struck, demanding action against the IRA 9. But the effects were not confined to Britain, as Militant commented, the worst reaction will probably be in Northern Ireland itself, and the brunt will be borne by precisely the people that the IRA claims to protect, the Catholic workers. 10. The intervention of the fascists, however, could not succeed in channeling the anger at the bombings in a sustained reactionary direction. Far more important in the consciousness of workers in Birmingham and elsewhere was the daily problem of struggling to live, and their ability to face up to the offensive that was being conducted by the employers. The rising tide of industrial struggle and intensive struggle was unfolding on the factory floor as the employers sought to take revenge for the defeat of their party in the general election. Reflecting the increased growth of Marxists in the factories, the pages of Militant carried many detailed reports of what was taking place. In September 1974, an article by Bill Mullins, who was a British Leyland senior shop steward representing 10,000 workers, wrote, "It is difficult for someone who has never worked in a car factory to visualize the destructive nature of the work, destructive to the body, because of the pace of the work, destructive to the mind, because of the mind-bending repetition of the work. A ferocious offensive was being conducted by management who were saying that the workers of BLMC must take a drop in their standards of living, because they will not be able to afford the sort of minimum pay increases that are necessary to remain at the present standard of living." The article concluded, "The answer must be that the workers are not prepared to pay for the mismanagement and incompetence of the company. The demands should be a minimum increase of £15 a week, the books to be opened for inspection to the trade unions. The nationalisation under workers' control of British Leyland 11. A sword of Damocles, in the form of threat and closure, was held over the heads of Leyland workers. Even though it was the country's largest private employer, about 160,000 workers at this time, reports circulated in the capitalist press showed that the company was in difficulties and was turning to the Labour government for financial handouts." Detailed explanatory articles by Militant supporters Bill Mullins and Bob Ashworth, who both worked at Rover Solihull, showed up the state of the company. Militant published a resolution from the Rover production workers in Seattle who, among other things, demanded that if BLMC was asking for government cash handouts, then the labor and trade union movement must demand that the Labour government nationalizes BLMC under workers' control, with members of the board of management being elected on the following basis: one-third elected by workers within BLMC, one-third elected by the TUC, one-third appointed by the government. 12. A meeting in Birmingham of all Leyland conveners nationally passed the resolution from the Rover Solihull plant which demanded workers' control. Some amendments were carried to the resolution, but, nevertheless, the fact that a significant group of workers had demanded workers' control of their industry indicated the mood that was developing. Even Labour MPs were affected. At a meeting, organised in Preston by the Labour Party Young Socialists, with 80 in attendance, a Labour MP, George Rogers, agreed with all the speakers that nationalisation was the only way out. This was in sharp contrast to the Labour government's proposals, to be implemented through the recently formed National Enterprise Board NEB. Militant pointed out that over half of British manufacturing output is controlled by the top 100 companies. Moreover, the Tories, through state intervention, had doled out between 1970 and 1974 £3 billion, £2 million a day to their friends in big business. Despite the clamour for the nationalisation of failing capitalist firms, the Labour government, through the NEB, continued the policy of bailing them out. Tony Benn, as industry minister, presided over this policy, which was increasingly criticised by both Labour and trade union members. The Shrewsbury too. At the same time, the building bosses and their legal hirelings were refusing to budge in the face of a wave of protests demanding the release of the jailed Shrewsbury pickets. In November, the appeal of the pickets was turned down. This was followed by protest strike action by Glasgow shipyard workers, building workers and others who marched on UKIP headquarters in Glasgow to demand action to free their jailed brothers. Similar action took place in Liverpool, Edinburgh and other parts of the country. Demands were sent to the Labour Home Secretary, Roy Jenkins, calling for the pickets to be released. A telegram from over 100 Merseyside building shop stewards to Jenkins declared, "We supported you in your re-election to the government. We ask you now to support us." The example of the release of the Pentonville dockers because of mass pressure was still fresh in the minds of both building workers and the 10 million strong trade union movement. However, calls to the TUC and the UKIP leadership unfortunately fell on deaf ears. The Shrewsbury pickets were to languish in jail. Against the general background of the industrial upsurge in militancy, in the 1970s, the lack of will of the TUC to mobilize the labor movement with all its power to force the release of the Shrewsbury pickets was perhaps the most shameful. Temperature rises, fire at our office. In the midst of these events, in February 1975, militants suffered a big blow. One of our buildings in Commercial Road, East London, was gutted by fire and some vital printing machinery, and most of the upper floors of the building were destroyed. This did not cripple militant, because the main headquarters was in a separate building. Nevertheless, the 14th of February issue of Militant was produced under exceptionally difficult conditions. An urgent appeal was made to Militant supporters, who responded magnificently. For a time, the paper had to be produced without colour. As soon as the means to go back to regular production was acquired, a colour 16-page paper was back in production,